Notes from America is supported by Future Hindsight, an award-winning podcast that shares big ideas about participating in American democracy, beyond voting, but short of running for office. Join host Mila Atmos for stimulating and incisive conversations with citizen changemakers on topics ranging from gerrymandering, policing equity, and voting rights. In this election year, Future Hindsight offers an unaffiliated perspective into what's at stake and how citizens can make an impact at the local, state, and national level. You'll always come away with something hopeful. Tune in every Thursday to get engaged and stay engaged.
Listener supported, WNYC Studios.
This is the United States of Anxiety, a show about the unfinished business of our history and its grip on our future.
This morning, the most vulnerable Americans now one step closer to getting a COVID vaccine.
We're going to do a nasal swab. So it is going to go back. It's going to be uncomfortable.
All these things that you're hearing about in the news is frustrating, but it hits different when you're going through it.
The confusion and anxiety many are feeling has drawn parallels to the HIV/AIDS epidemic of the 1980s.
Transparency has always been my currency. Why couldn't I tell my mother I had HIV?
Our friends were getting sick and our friends were dying. If you were a person of conscience, you had to get involved.
The main reason I'm here is to scatter my own ashes. I'm going to die of AIDS in probably 2 years.
What AIDS revealed was not the problem of the virus. What AIDS revealed was the problems of our society.
Welcome to the show. I'm Kai Wright. Last week, I was sitting in a clinic waiting for results from a rapid COVID test when I had this vivid flash of memory. I was snatched back to being a young gay man sitting in an HIV clinic in the mid-1990s waiting for test results. Because that was a new routine back then, right? Going in for regular HIV tests, waiting for the results. And for me, at least, no matter what actual risks I'd taken, always, always feeling dread. Because it was so fraught, it was about so much more than physical health. HIV has been a constant, intimate companion my whole adult life. And if you're someone who came of sexual age in the 80s and 90s, especially if you're gay or transgender, then there's a good chance HIV has occupied a lot of space in your mind and heart as well. Whether we're positive or negative, it doesn't matter. The virus has just been present. So when COVID-19 crashed our lives back in February, a lot of people immediately began thinking about those early pre-treatment days of HIV. From a public health perspective, from a political perspective, certainly, but also it triggered something in our emotional memories. We're going to spend this week's show in that space, reminding ourselves of the history of treatment activism in particular around HIV and trying to apply lessons from that history to COVID. We've just had World AIDS Day. Next summer will mark 40 maddening years since the CDC first reported on the virus. HIV has killed tens of millions of people since that report. 38 million people continue to live with it today. Thankfully, there are now treatments that make it livable, though they are still not universally accessible. And as with COVID, New York City was one of the first places in the U.S. to be overwhelmed by HIV. Our executive producer, Karen Frohman, was a young woman in the city at the time. And when COVID hit here, Karen found herself rustling around in her closet, digging out a recording she made 34 years ago, when there was still so much we didn't know about HIV. We've asked her to open that time capsule for us, and she begins by just remembering how it all started for her.
Well, I volunteered for a small agency to go in and to clean and to bring food. And so I remember going and meeting this young man. His name was John. And when I first started to care for him, yeah, I felt like I was taking care of, you know, someone my brother's age. And then within a few weeks, I mean, this young man aged like before my eyes. And I mean, he was gone in 3.5 months. And it is so frightening to see life just slip away.
Well, it reminds me of particularly this spring when we were hearing and people would go to the hospital and within, you know, it's so quickly people would go from not feeling well to not being able to breathe to being gone.
Yeah, that's right. And at that time, it was happening to these young, vibrant people who were just really bringing so much to New York City. And so after that, I decided to begin to record people and to basically start to document some of what I was seeing.
I'm wired.
And so I met Michael Calvert through a friend of a friend.
Did you all get specific questions that you want to ask me?
It was July of 1986, and he invited me up to his apartment.
Maybe we should mic him with a regular mic.
And Judy Wenning, who was my producing partner at the time.
How have you been feeling?
I've been feeling rotten. It's the truth.
He was 27 years old when I met him. He was living in Chelsea.
I don't really know why, but just rotten. And I think maybe it's been as mentally a problem as it has physically, the physical pain and the...
And at that time, I think the thing that was really grounding him, he was a member of the People with AIDS Coalition, which was an advocacy group and a support group for these people who were getting sick. There was so much of a stigma around it. People didn't understand it. And Michael had started giving talks, educating healthcare workers about what this disease was doing.
You know, I showed people my lesions today, a spot that I don't even look at on a regular basis. I don't want to see them. I put on a long sleeve shirt so that I don't see them, not so that other people can't. So it was really odd today for me to uncover them for myself in order to show them to other people.
I mean, Michael was a little self-conscious about what AIDS had done to his appearance.
How did that feel?
They wanted to, you know, ask questions about it, and that was okay, and it didn't bother me a bit.
But he was still very cute and slight build, very thin, and he was Southern. He'd moved to New York when he was 20 years old, and so that's the thing. He was young.
I can show you a beautiful picture of me at age 20.
I like your hair long.
I like my hair long, too.
And he'd come from Gadsden, Alabama, where he'd been a straight-A student.
I smoked pot after school with the kids and told them what to study so they could make, you know, passing grades.
He'd started acting in local theater, and I think he'd been kind of a star in his hometown.
Never had a pimple. And then went to the theater every afternoon, evening, and had this whole other group of friends and wild, mystical, free-spirited type friends, and met a lover and things.
So you didn't live at home?
I did live at home, but I kept my curfew all those nights. My curfew was, because I was smart, because I was honest, my curfew was 1 o'clock. They'd rather me be home before that, but they knew I was in the theater. I mean, I was in the newspaper every 6 weeks. So, I mean, it wasn't like they didn't trust me.
But they also knew you were in a relationship with
him. And they didn't know I was in a relationship with this man.
So when Michael came to New York, that's what he wanted to do. He wanted to be an actor. And he talks about that moment in New York City as being totally life-changing for him.
I was wild, and it was wonderful, and I was not afraid to experience anything and everything when I first came to New York. But I wasn't disciplined, and I didn't get what I really came here for as far as acting, and I allowed the discovery part of my life to take over and just to do what I wanted to do.
So to support himself, Michael had developed a flower business, which you would, you know, be walking down a street in the West Village and these little outrageously beautiful flower shops had appeared, and it was, you know, orchids and bird of paradise and stuff that just in New York City at that time, which was pretty run down, it was just a gorgeous contrast.
The sad part is, well, there's so many sad parts, but the flower design business was just taking off. And I mean by taking off, I mean he was getting some big clients, and it was becoming finally lucrative.
So that's Rick Kitzman. And Karen, I got to say, I'm really glad you invited me to join you when you met him because, you know, having heard all these recordings of Michael from 3 decades ago, I was really longing to meet somebody who was close to him.
Yeah, Rick came to New York City in the late 70s from Colorado, and they met through mutual friends and started dating.
When you said we want to ask about Michael Calvert, I mean, when I read that, bam, all of these emotions just came. It was so out of the blue. And I was just overcome for like 5 seconds of, all these thoughts and feelings and emotions just thinking about, you know, Michael Calvert that came up from that time.
Can you tell us a little bit about him, how you knew him?
Well, it was about 83, 84. My roommate, Sarah Myers, and I threw a party called the Well Read Party. So not only did everybody wear red, but it was also about reading books. So, you know, it was one of those clever, witty New York things you did in the 80s. And Michael came and we just hit it off. I mean, he was adorably cute. And he was funnier than hell. And, you know, I grew to just love that Southern charm. But I remember the well-read party. We invited practically everybody we knew. And Michael did the flowers. And what I remember so distinctly was he brought as many red flowers as he could find. Yeah. And so that little apartment was just covered with bouquets of red flowers. And so we wanted a boutonniere for me and we wanted a corsage for Sarah. And there's no such thing as a red orchid. The closest is a deep orange. And so that was her corsage. And then he was done putting up all the flowers. And I'm going, well, what about me? Where's my boutonniere? And so he said, oh, I didn't forget you. And so he took an anthurium. And those are those, well, we call them the little boy flowers because they have blood red, more or less leaves with a stamen of about an inch, inch and a half long of bright gold yellow. And he took one of those and he cut it into a triangle and pinned it to my shirt, and that was my corsage. And I just thought it was so amazingly creative. You know, Michael and I, we just had a good time with each other. And the flip side was it became really a time of grief and fear and eventually rage. This friend got sick. I would hear about this friend who got sick. And the situation for me became just untenable. And so it was in 85 that I decided I just had to leave New York because I knew something really bad was going to happen to me. I remember the last time I'm almost positive it's the last time I saw Michael. And I think he was taking me to LaGuardia. And we were in his van and he had, you know, the back was filled with flowers. And as I recall, he wished I would stay, but, you know, he understood. And I remember he talked about this client and that client and this party and that party. And, you know, you could tell there was this joy of what he was doing because he found something. You know, it may not have been the reason he moved to New York, but that he loved doing and that he was becoming successful doing. And I think for Michael, that was a new achievement. And, you know, it was just really fun to be a part of that and to hear his enthusiasm, you know, contrasted with the sadness of leaving each other. And, you know, I think part of that sadness was I think on some level, it's possible we knew that we wouldn't see each other again.
Is the tape going? Because I want to say this. I did have a good time when I first came to New York, and I'm still having a good time. And I really love my life, you know, and I think that that makes me a special person because I don't think there are a lot of people in this world that do. And, you know, the good times have not stopped just because I hurt, and it's really important for me to try to share that with people and to try to help them understand that you can get through difficulty and still have a wonderful, beautiful life.
So what did ultimately happen with Michael and his health?
So, you know, Judy and I met Michael about a year after he was diagnosed. So he had had a little bit of time to come to terms with what was happening to him. But he was getting weaker and I think sicker.
I guess the main problem is just the pain. I mean, I try to describe it in therapy. This is more like heartache pain. I mean, that kind of pain. Pain that's all over, that's indescribable, that's... You can't put your finger on it. It just hurts all over.
And so I think you can hear in his voice the mental anguish that he was experiencing.
I dealt with feelings of giving up, wondering where my hope was, wondering if I was going to stay that way, not believing that I could possibly stay that way because it was miserable. And it would turn in from 2 days of misery to 3 to a week, and then I thought, my God, I can't. How am I going to go on this way? I absolutely can't. And I'm wondering, is it going to be another week or months or the rest of my life? Not believing that it could be the rest of my life, but wondering was a major step, a major thing for me, because I never wondered in my life about going on.
You've never felt hopeless before then?
Not really.
Another really terrible thing about that time was that some of these young men were shunned by their families. Their parents cut them off. They wouldn't talk to them.
You told your mother on the phone.
I told my mother on the phone. I had to call her at work. She didn't have a phone.
But Michael actually had a good relationship with his parents and his siblings.
My father was the most upset.
And I think he was touched by how accepting and supportive they were.
They loved me anyway, without any question, without any hesitation. And I think that meant more than anything. They didn't have to say it. I could tell, you know. I was there. I was with them. Instead, I told them. I mean, the telephone doesn't keep people apart. It doesn't separate people. It really brings people together. And I think that even though it was on the phone, you know, that I told my mother, she loved me anyway. I mean.
Well, your family really cares about you, it sounds.
Oh, yeah. I'm very, very lucky in that sense. They're not hiding away. I think they're struggling to stay away in as much as I want them to.
But he wanted to be independent. He wanted to continue to take care of himself and live his life. And I hear how much he was struggling with the idea of his decline.
I mean, people poke and prod, and especially mentally, not necessarily physically, but they want to know. They want to... You know, well, how can I help you? I'll do anything. You just call me. Just call me. Now, whose need is that? It ain't mine.
So you want to stay independent how long?
Forever. I mean, just like you, I would think. You know, everybody wants to be free. And I don't want to be dependent. I don't want to be dependent on anyone. And I'm liable to die before I get the chance to express a lot of what's inside of me.
I mean, you know, he was 27 years old. He was really just trying to maintain his equilibrium.
You know, I've thought about this a lot, too, as a gay man who came of age just after Michael's generation, you know, is a lot of men his age, they're almost like first generation that show up in a place like New York and San Francisco and Washington, D.C., from wherever they had come, and they had to do so much to create their lives in those places. They literally created the gay world in which I now live. They made space for themselves, and they were just getting that space. It was just coming into fruition. And just when he's got it, to be faced with something like this.
I'm not crazy about the fact that I have AIDS. It's difficult, and it's a real burden. It's a burden because there's a certain responsibility to helping other people through it, because it's such a difficult thing. It's a burden because it hurts. And I also don't think that this is necessarily going to kill me before, you know, my time. I mean, it may and it may not. And I'm doing everything I can so that it doesn't. That's part of the burden.
When I met him in 86, he swung between feeling very down to believing that he was gonna be a survivor. Mm. And of course there was a quest at that time to find a cure.
I fortunately don't think that I'm gonna be in captivity forever. There's probably something on the way. And you know, I still feel like I'll beat the odds. I mean, they say 18 months, I say 19, they say 20, and I say, oh, I'm 24. I mean, I don't care what they say. You know, I know how I feel. It's been a year, and you know, and I feel like I got at least another good year in me, and by that time something should happen that'll help me get through another year, and by that time a cure, and by that time. I mean, it's how I really think. It's how I really, really, really think. Is that denial? Is that stupid? Is that not recognizing the reality? No, because I do know the reality.
I just hear such confidence and optimism in the face of this diagnosis, in the face of this disease that I now know, you know, would kill so many people.
Yeah.
Whatever statistics you quote, I'm going to beat. I'm going to be the person that changes those statistics. I can tell you that right now. I mean, no way am I just living 18 more months.
One of the things that taking this tape, listening to it 34 years later, it's partly just the act of remembering and the act of saying that this man walked the streets and contributed to the life of our city. And Michael died about 5 months after we recorded him. You know, he died too young, but that's something we can do, is remember.
At a time when we've buried 200-something thousand people.
Yeah. Yeah.
Just about out of tape. Oh. So, you know what I want you to do is just be quiet for a while until it runs out.
Oh.
Do you ever feel like there's nothing new in the news? You know, like there are urgent things happening in the world, but all you hear is noise. That's where What Next comes in, a daily news show we love from Slate. They tell you the stories you haven't heard before or a different side to the stories you thought you already knew. Join host Mary Harris every day as she cuts through the noise so that together we can all figure out what next. Follow and listen wherever you get your podcasts. Welcome back. This is the United States of Anxiety, and I'm Kai Wright. This week, we are asking what we can learn from nearly 40 years of the HIV/AIDS pandemic as we approach 1 year of living with COVID-19. Both pandemics hit the New York area with particular fury at their outset. And so for the rest of this show, I want to invite you to call in with your own memories of the early HIV epidemic. And as we take your calls, I'm joined by somebody who was here fighting to save lives in his community, which is now my community, and who has also been thinking a great deal about our response to COVID-19. Greg Gonsalves was a founder of the Treatment Action Group in 1992, which grew out of ACT UP, and he has never stopped being an AIDS activist. He's also now an epidemiologist and co-director of the Global Health Justice Partnership at Yale University. And he's been writing about our national response to COVID for The Nation magazine. Greg, thanks for joining us.
Anytime, Kai. Thanks for having me.
So, Greg, I'd like to start with some of your own early memories of the HIV epidemic here in New York. I know you grew up here in Long Island. You went off to college, but you came home to New York in 1990. And by that time, you were already a member of ACT UP. And I gather your own activism was at least partly driven by your effort to just keep your boyfriend alive at the time. We just heard Michael Calvert, that young man wondering aloud back in 1986, I guess it was, about whether science would catch up in time to save his life. Do you recall how you guys felt at that time while not only waiting for science to catch up, but also fighting to make it happen? What was that like for you guys?
Well, it just was unbearable, frankly. I just like hearing those voices from the past, over the past half hour in your show was just incredibly painful because, you know, I remember being in ACT UP meetings on Monday nights and people coming up to me and talking to me about cryptosporidiosis, which was the disease that Treatment and Data Committee of ACT UP had assigned to me when I first got there, and asking about new treatments and realizing there were no new treatments, and the person in front of me was not likely to be here, you know, 2 months, 3 months, 4 months down the line. And so, you know, we had very bad luck for the first 16 years of the AIDS epidemic until we saw highly active antiviral therapy appear. And it was one sort of disappointment after another as much as we kept fighting.
Yeah.
And that uncertainty about where science would go and how fast, and I mean, on a different scale, at least, it feels certainly how a lot of people felt this summer as the hospitals on the East Coast filled up, at least, from COVID. Did it seem familiar to you at the time, or are these apples and oranges?
No, it still feels familiar. I mean, you know, the weird thing for me is that, you know, the sort of terror of not knowing if you're going to catch it, if you catch it, if you'll survive, you know, thinking about when there's going to be an effective treatment, when there's going to be a vaccine, you know, all sent me into sort of flashback mode. But this wasn't just happening to the LGBTQ community, communities of color, you know, people who use drugs, et cetera. It was happening to like an entire world. And it was just a different kind of scale of experience, which, you know, I thought after going through the AIDS epidemic, nothing could sort of compete with that. But, you know, the past, you know, 10, 11 months have been just quite a ride.
Quite a ride. I mean, you know, it's certainly flashback for me, and I wasn't an adult in the 80s, and so I wasn't losing friends in the immediate way. But the people that I knew and then lost in the 90s, I found it very difficult to separate emotionally the two events.
Yeah, no, I agree. It's hard.
Well, so what's certainly not similar, though, to the HIV/AIDS pandemic is how rapidly science has, in fact, moved on COVID. You know, it's worth pointing out that there is still no vaccine for HIV. And honestly, you know, I've said a couple times in this hour, as a Black man, as a gay man, I feel some kind of way about that fact. And I wonder, talking to you, is that even fair of me? Am I comparing things incorrectly?
I mean, you know, it's remarkable to me that, you know, by the end of the year, we're going to have multiple COVID-19 vaccines approved by the FDA. And, you know, we're still waiting for an AIDS vaccine. You know, I feel enormous anger still that we didn't have an Operation Warp Speed for us back in the 80s and 90s. And that as much as Trump botched the response to the COVID-19 epidemic, there has been a wholesale mobilization across the United States to find a vaccine, at least. And so I feel like, you know, what about us? What happened back in the 80s and 90s that said we weren't worth the fight?
Yeah. I'm talking with Greg Gonzalez about how his 30 years of AIDS activism colors his view of the COVID-19 pandemic. And Greg, you're joining us from New Haven, Connecticut, that mm-hmm. area of the state stretching up from New York City through the suburbs. It's often called one of the most unequal places in the country, in terms of income and wealth, at least. And, you know, and that certainly tracks with race as well. You've talked about this kind of inequality and how it shaped healthcare over the generations. How do you think it shaped the political response to HIV, you know, that we're now talking about?
You know, it's just, I think you have to go way back past COVID, past HIV. You have to go deeper into American history to figure out how we got to where we are today. You know, there was an article by Janina Interlandi, who is on the editorial board of the New York Times in the 1619 issue of the New York Times Magazine last year, called "Why Doesn't America Have National Healthcare? It Has Everything to Do with Race." And she talked about in that article about how after the Civil War, you know, smallpox was raging through the American South, and former slave owners were wondering, should we do something? You know, we want to save these people mostly because we can lure them back onto plantations to work for us, but we don't want them to be too healthy, because otherwise, you know, they may upset the political balance of the American South. A guy named Jim Downs, who is a professor at the University of Connecticut, but who's now at Gettysburg College, wrote in this book called Dying for Freedom that healthcare in America represented white ambivalence at every turn. And if you start thinking about that through the New Deal programs, where African Americans were excluded from those benefits, to the Hill-Burton Act, when they expanded hospitals in the South in the 40s and 50s, under this express agreement that Southern governors could pick where those hospitals went, and guess where they went, all the way through the sort of 80s and 90s, you realize we've been playing the sort of white ambivalence at every turn. Every time there's a health crisis in America, race comes up and we ask who's getting infected, who's affected, and who matters. And we saw it in AIDS, and we've seen it in COVID-19. It's a legacy that stretches way, way back past the 20th century into the 19th, and probably before that for us.
Yeah. I wonder about how that same thing then, when we think about COVID, I have to say there was a time when, you know, at least this summer, when it felt like the Trump administration's denial of what was going on was tied up in his dismissal and fear-mongering of cities, which is to say Black people and immigrants and gays and the like. Does that feel accurate too?
Oh, yeah. I mean, I don't know if he said it or I just imagine him saying it, that like, is it our people who are getting infected or is it, you know, I don't think he felt like it was the people who mattered to him who were getting infected during the past 8 to 10, 11 months that we've been living with this disease. But I think his pathology is so much more deep and sort of inhumane in that he can care less who else gets it. He's not always racist, misogynist, and homophobe, but his narcissism is so deep that the world could burn down around him and he wouldn't really give a damn.
Let's go to Louis in Bed-Stuy. Louis, welcome to the show.
Yeah, hi, Kai. Yeah, I was diagnosed in 86, December 1986. And so it's over 30-some years, and I remember back about New York. Now I'm HIV undetectable and Hep C cured. You know, as a former heroin user. In July of this year, I caught COVID. Mm. And, wow, I can't believe I survived it.
Did you have to, were you hospitalized?
Yes, I was in Brooklyn Hospital. And I was very, I had the best doctors. Same doctors that has been giving me care with my treatment with living with HIV. You know, and also the cure for Hep C as well. It's co-infected. I was a member of ACT UP. The words of an ACT UP member I go to over and over again. And his name is Vito Russo. He said, someday the AIDS crisis, and I put it in the COVID crisis, will end. And when that time has come and gone, there will be people on the planet, Black people, white people, gay and straight, who will have remembered that there was once a terrible disease and that there were a group of people who were moved to stand up, act up, and fight back. And some of them died so that others may live and be free.
Thank you for that remembrance, Louis. And I'm so happy that you were able to overcome both diagnoses. Can I ask you quickly before I let you go, when thinking about being diagnosed with HIV in 1986, when there wasn't treatment available, and then COVID this summer, when it was also a lot of people were dying from it, I just wonder how you felt emotionally with those two things. I mean, how did you deal with that sort of uncertainty?
I was fortunate to have a network. You know, I belong to a network, Vocal New York, Voices of Community Advocates and Leaders. Mm-hmm. And so being connected was so important to my resilience. Emotionally, yeah, I had my moments. It's okay to cry, you know, even though you're from the sky.
Yes, it is.
But, and I was just very fortunate that I twice a week go out, you know, to... with a team, you know, and we go to high drug trafficking areas in Bed-Stuy and Williamsburg and Red Hook and reach out, do outreach, you know, providing masks, you know, for people that are homeless and on the streets or just being released from prison and getting them connected into detoxes and spreading the word, you know, that there's hope.
Well, Louis, thank you for that work and for your yes. testimony. Thanks for calling. Greg, what do you think about that in terms of, you know, one of the things that we've heard is that COVID is so much more difficult for, you know, for people with compromised immune systems. Has there been any research or any thought about what it means for people who are HIV positive?
Well, I think the main point is that if you're suppressed on antiretroviral therapy, you should be treated as any other patient coming into a hospital. You shouldn't be considered sort of at higher risk than probably people for your own age group. I mean, people living with HIV who have uncontrolled virus and have frank immunosuppression, I think that's another story. But if you're right. controlled on antiretroviral therapy, I think nobody's suggesting that you should have a different outcome with COVID than your negative peers.
Which is just a testament to how far science has come, at least on the treatment side, if not the distribution of those treatments.
Exactly.
Back on a personal note for you, I understand, you know, that 1995 was really a tough year for you. Can you take us back there? I feel like there's a lot of people facing similarly intense grief right now, and I just wanted to hear how you faced that kind of onslaught.
That year, I lost my cousin, who basically I grew up around the corner from in my neighborhood growing up on Long Island, and lost a good friend of mine, Jay Funk, who was the former boyfriend of my former boyfriend. So, but, you know, tended to two people dying in 1995 and in the midst of it, finding out my own diagnosis. And this is like, you know, months just before we get the news of highly active antiretroviral therapy emerging on the scene. And, you know, as the previous segment from earlier in the show said, you know, just a few more months and something will happen, and a few more months will happen, and they could have beaten it too. And so to find my own diagnosis happening on sort of the cusp of the advent of real treatment for HIV, it just, it was a miracle for me. But, you know, there's no shortage of guilt that, like, the people I love, if they'd just been able to hang on for a few more months, they might be with us here today.
Mm. Guilt, you say?
I don't know. I mean, you know, why did I survive? Why did all my friends survive? Not all of them, but, like, you know, there's a bunch of my friends, Peter Staley, David Barr, mm-hmm. others who survived this, you know, against all odds. And yes, we had great health care. But, you know, the just inordinate amount of loss we all faced, it's just like, you know, you start to think, like, why me? Why did I survive this when so many beautiful, wonderful people who enriched our world, like the profile of the young man you featured earlier in the show, are gone from us forever?
Hey, everybody. So I want to ask your help with something. A huge part of what we're doing with this show is building a community of people who want to share the joy and the work of creating and living in a healthy, plural society. That's why we've started taking calls on the live show and soliciting your tweets and your voicemails here.
Hey, this is Michael from Raleigh, North Carolina.
This is Ida in Austin, Texas.
Hi, Kai. My name is Dorian from Queens, New York.
My wildest dreams and imaginations, it's going to be hard for me to get through this note to you guys without getting emotional.
It's all part of building a community. And you can do two things to help build our community. First off, just invite somebody to join you in it. Maybe even start listening together on Sunday evenings. But however you do it, invite other people in. Second, you can leave a review on whatever app you're using to listen right now. You can give us a rating there, that's nice, but also leave a comment. Why do you listen? Why should others join you in listening? Again, think of it as making an invitation. It's how community works. So thanks in advance for doing either or both of those things. And even if you can't do either of them, thanks for being part of our community. Welcome back. This is the United States of Anxiety, and I'm Kai Wright. This week, we are asking what we can learn from the nearly 40-year-old HIV/AIDS pandemic as we approach 1 year living with COVID-19. I'm joined by Greg Gonzalez, who is co-director of the Global Health Justice Partnership at Yale University and has been an AIDS activist for 3 decades. And Greg, let's get one more caller in here. Paul, who's in the Financial District. Paul, welcome to the show.
Hi, how are you, Kai?
I'm good. Do you have a memory of that time, of the early HIV epidemic, that you want to share?
I was working in the I work in the film industry now. I was working in the restaurant industry in Chelsea and living in Chelsea at the time. And my mom worked at St. Vincent's Hospital. And the parallel, of course, is now that my daughter is a nurse in Langeau. And the similarity of stories that I'm hearing and the terror and the fear that they were both experiencing working in the health industry at the time is kind of shocking. And the stories my mom would tell me about how people were afraid of bringing into the rooms at St. Vincent's for the AIDS patients. And that same similar terror that my daughter is experiencing really sort of, I feel like it's a strange experience of going full circle, but in a horrible way.
Thank you for that, Paul. Greg, I want to ask you because, you know, one of the things that there's a lot of these very difficult memories of the HIV epidemic that are resonant right now. But part of why I wanted to talk to you is there's also, I find there are a number of things that are quite inspiring about that period to me. And I want to ask you about that because, you know, you were present at a time when a group of people in our community said, you know what, we'll take care of ourselves and we will force the power that exists to value our lives. And I just wonder about that now. And where do we see that connection with COVID now?
Well, actually in New York City, I think you do see it because there's something called the COVID-19 Working Group. Maybe not as visible as ACT UP New York, but it has a lot of the alums from ACT UP New York and some younger folks. But also some of the researchers from the time of the 80s and 90s who are doing on HIV that are all working together to think about how to improve both local policy in the city, but also national policy on research, treatment, testing, all the things, you know, ACT UP like to focus on back in the 80s and 90s around HIV. And so there, you know, it's an infectious disease. So all the infectious disease docs from the 80s who are still around doing this work are on the front lines for COVID, but also the people who remember the AIDS epidemic, activist groups like Rise and Resist in New York and others have mobilized themselves around COVID-19. It's not a surprise that it's the old ACT UP vets and the newer generation sort of allied with them that are stepping up both in New York City, but also around the country.
Well, on that score, thinking about, you know, I mean, all the treatment activism of both the past and present in HIV, and then thinking about the period we're now entering with vaccine rollout, what are lessons there? Because we've now got these very promising vaccines. You wrote in The Nation that you don't expect them to be a big part of our rollout of our dealing with COVID-19, at least for much of 2021. Do you still think that's true? And if so, why? And how does it relate to what we've seen in the past in dealing with pharmaceutical companies?
Well, one is, you know, I think I would revise my opinion and say they're going to be an important feature of the next year. But it's the devil is not in the vaccines themselves, but in the distribution. Mm-hmm. And so the point is that vaccines are only as good as a shot in the arm to the people who need to get it. And, you know, one of the lessons of the advent of highly active antiviral therapy is that when certain people get access to things, they forget about other people. Yeah. Andrew Sullivan wrote an article in the New York Times Magazine in the mid-1990s saying, when plagues end, which meant AIDS was over for him. And for a generation of gay white men, they took their antiviral pills, they took their health insurance and went home. And so are we going to see a similar sort of two-tiered retreat for COVID-19 in which certain segments of our population get access to the vaccine while we let pockets of the virus sort of persist into 2022, 2023, because the vaccine simply doesn't reach there in time or which is significant penetration.
What do you see now or look for in the Biden administration to make sure that's not happening? I mean, that Andrew Sullivan 1996 article really defined much of the next 10 years of my life in trying to sort of respond to it in the Black community. What do you see? What are you looking for to make sure we are not back in that place?
Well, one is that, you know, we're talking about should nursing home residents, should healthcare workers get access to the vaccine? Should this group or that group? But, you know, the point is that across sort of the sort of age demographics and the sort of settings like nursing homes, we have to admit it's just a matter of pure fact that the virus cut a different kind of swath through communities of color in the United States. And we're going to have to figure out a way to make sure that equity is part of what the Biden administration does when it rolls out vaccines. I'm happy that my colleague here at Yale, Marcela Nunez-Smith, whose work on health equity all her life, is going to take up a post with the new Biden administration specifically on health equity. And I'm hoping that that's a sign that the administration is going to be putting equity and access to vaccines and any other sort of interventions we put in place for COVID-19 front and center, which, you know, we didn't necessarily see in the 1990s in the United States for antiretroviral treatment.
What about the potential reluctance of people to take the vaccines? We see survey data that suggests African Americans in particular might be reluctant. We spent a lot of years fighting misinformation in the Black community about HIV. Where do you see that headed?
Well, I mean, it's going to be an issue. It's not just people in the African American community. I think they polled New York City police officers, and half of them said they wouldn't take it. And so we have a big uphill job to do to get people to take the vaccine. And, you know, as we learned from HIV, peer-based education is the best way to go. And so, yes, the White House can use the bully pulpit of the presidency to make the case that everybody should take a jab in the arm. But we're going to have to sort of build a legion of community health workers that are in the communities, that are part of the communities they come from, to help vaccinate people, to help educate people, to help them through the next few months. The point is that it's going to have to be from the bottom up and not necessarily just from the top down. We can have all the sort of best laid plans to get vaccines out the door, but the rubber hits the road in neighborhoods in New York City and New Haven, where people have struggled to get access to healthcare on an equal basis for many, many years. And so a vaccine coming along doesn't necessarily mean it's going to get to them with great speed or efficiency.
Last 30 seconds, any parting thoughts for people about what we're going to face now for the next coming months with COVID?
It's going to be really rough. The vaccine and the immunity that we might all get by it is something for thinking of the summer of 2021. Keep your masks on, keep your distance. The holidays are coming. If you can pass up this Christmas, Hanukkah, and Kwanzaa, do it, because we all want to be around for next year so we can be together again.
Greg Gonzalez is co-director of the Global Health Justice Partnership at Yale University. He's been an AIDS activist for 3 decades. You can follow his writing on COVID-19 at The Nation magazine. Greg, thanks for joining us.
Anytime, Kai.
United States of Anxiety is a production of WNYC Studios. A special thanks to the family of Michael Calvert for opening themselves and their hearts to us when we reached out all these years after his death. I know that had to be tough. So thanks for allowing us to share him with our community here on the show. Jared Paul mixed the podcast version this week. Kevin Bristow and Matthew Miranda were at the boards for the live show. Special thanks to Ed Haber for his technical assistance, making Karen's 1986 recording work for a digital world. Our team also includes Carolyn Adams, Emily Botine, Jenny Casas, Marianne McCune, Christopher Wirth, and Vera Lynn Williams. Our theme music was written by Hannes Brown and performed by the Outer Borough Brass Band. Karen Frohman is our executive producer, and I am Kai Wright. You can keep in touch with me on Twitter at Kai_Wright. And as always, I hope you'll join us for the live version of the show next Sunday, 6 p.m. Eastern. You can stream it at WNYC.org or tell your smart speaker, play WNYC. Till then, thanks for listening. Take care of yourselves.
Notes from America is supported by Future Hindsight, an award-winning podcast that shares big ideas about participating in American democracy, beyond voting, but short of running for office. Join host Mila Atmos for stimulating and incisive conversations with citizen changemakers on topics ranging from gerrymandering, policing equity, and voting rights. In this election year, Future Hindsight offers an unaffiliated perspective into what's at stake and how citizens can make an impact at the local, state, and national level. You'll always come away with something hopeful. Tune in every Thursday to get engaged and stay engaged.